Indie Media is DIY News. It is about people reporting their own news directly, without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media. There are now almost 100 Indie Media websites or IMCs worldwide, providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns, and protests. The project started 3 years ago, covering the massive Seattle protests that shut down the World Trade Organization summit. Uncensored and unsponsored, indie media sites can be updated literally anytime, anywhere, and by anyone. The open-to-all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news. What you are about to hear are some highlights from those global websites and the UK's very own indie media site. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the Newswire show for this week. Well, we're bringing you updates for DICEY, and which is the campaign against the arms fair in London, and
all sorts of stories from around the globe, and including lots of other folks that's going on in England and in the air. In fact, a bizarre story from British Airways.
Yeah, we've got a lot of really good stories coming up. Anyway, this is following up after last week's report from Schnooze about RFID radio chips being implanted into products we purchase and thus enabling their or your tracking. We thought you should know that these chips are already being used in the UK. Bum, bum, bum.
Oh my
from
God.
Tesco's in Cambridge and Sandhurst to Asda in Nottingham, not to mention Marks and Spencer's and Woolworths. Privacy groups are outraged. For more information about this invasion of privacy, see www.schnooze.org.uk. That's schnews.org.uk, as well as checking out www.nocards.org.
And Campaign Against the Arms Trade this week issued a press release about the forthcoming anti-arms fair protest set for London in September. Here are some extracts.
Okay. London Docklands could be brought to a standstill in September as thousands of protesters challenge a huge arms bazaar. Arms buyers from Syria, Pakistan, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Colombia, Lebanon, Bulgaria and Kenya were invited to attend the last DICEY London Arms Fair in September 2001. More than 600 arms companies and suppliers have already booked stands at DICEY 2003, making it the UK's largest and big ever arms fair. Government ministers are expected to attend the fair, which is funded by the Ministry of Defence.
Almost one third of the world's countries will attend this international arms bazaar. It's absolutely scandalous that British taxpayers are being forced to contribute hundreds of thousands of pounds to help some of the world's most dangerous states sell weapons on our doorsteps, said Martin Hogbin, campaigns coordinator at Campaigns Against the Arms Trade.
Our government likes to project itself as a force for good in the world. The reality is that by hosting this arms fair, the UK has become an international force for hypocrisy. That's why thousands of ordinary people will protest against the London Arms Bazaar.
There is already a huge UK and international interest in the events planned against the London's Arms Bazaar. Protesters are coming to London from all over the country, and others are expected from Italy, Belgium, Spain, the Netherlands and Germany. Planned events include a mass demonstration in central London, a facing the arms traders protest at London Docklands, a counter-conference and non-violent direct actions and blockades.
The movement against London's Arms Bazaar has grown so strong that other groups are arranging their own events and protests. They include Disarm DICEY 2003, see www.dsei.org, East London Against the Arms Fair, London Reclaim the Streets and Critical Mass. DICEY, spelt D-S-I-E-I, stands for Defence Systems International.
In 1999, when the exhibition took place at both London Docklands and at Chertsey in Surrey, investigative journalists uncovered two separate breaches of the International Landmines Act. A Romanian arms fair had brochures on their stall for anti-personnel landmines, weapons which were banned by the Act. The firm later admitted to the British government they were there. An investigative journalist was told by the firm's salesman the equipment could be supplied, even though it was against the law.
In December of the same year, it emerged that another arms manufacturer, Pakistan Ordnance Factories, had offered anti-personnel landmines for sale after meeting undercover journalists at the DSEI arms fair. The resulting documentary revealed the journalists were offered anti-personnel landmines as well as thousands of small arms for shipment to Sudan.
At DICEY 2001, which took place at the new Excel Conference Centre at London Docklands, countries sent delegates to buy arms on British soil, which were later condemned as sponsoring terrorism by both US President Bush and Prime Minister Blair, as well as arms buyers from Syria and Pakistan. Countries known to have terrible human rights records were also invited to shop in London for arms. They included Saudi Arabia, Colombia, Algeria and Israel.
This year, Indie Media and other alternative and grassroots media groups will be setting up an independent media centre to cover the week of protests that span the 6th to the 12th of September. So expect to hear a whole lot more about this in the coming weeks.
You are listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Bypassing the corporate media machine.
Yes, that was the Sex Pistols, believe it or not. Okay, here we go. Okay, yeah, here we go then. We've got a story coming at you from here. Okay, a couple of weeks ago, John Gilmore and his partner tried to fly to London from America on British Airways. They showed their passports and got through all the rigmarole and were seated on their plane when it taxied off towards the takeoff. Suddenly, a flight steward loomed in front of them and demanded that John remove a small one-inch badge pinned in his lapel. John declined, saying that it was a political statement and that the airline had no right to censor passengers' political speech. The badge was created by a political activist, Imai Koyama, and it said, "Suspected terrorist." Then the captain of the plane requested and then demanded that John remove the badge. He said that the captain said it would endanger the aircraft and that John would commit a federal crime if he did not take it off. They turned the plane round and brought it back to the gate, delaying 300 passengers on a full flight, and removed both John and his partner from the plane. The man's partner asked why she was not allowed to fly as well, since she wasn't wearing or carrying any objectionable badges. She was told it was because of her association with John. Later, John asked whether he would be permitted to fly if he wore other badges, perhaps saying, "Hooray for Tony Blair!" A stewardess said she thought that would be okay.
A tenant in Brighton's council-run Horsden Traveller site has been given 3 days' notice to quit for complaining once too often that the on-site toilet and shower block has been broken for 6 months. Rather than fix the block, the council have decided it would be easier and presumably cheaper to evict the tenant, who is also recovering from a recent hip operation.
And this week, the Kremlin's human rights envoy, Abdulhakim Sultigov, accused NGOs of terrorist activities, psychological war and propaganda, and moral terror. The crimes? Revealing the Russian military's abuses of Chechens. Sultigov went on to say that pseudo-NGOs are misleading international opinion by skillfully combining truth, semi-truth and blatant lies in what he called an attempt to justify terrorists' methods through certain political ideas, as the Russians say, chivo chivo. According to Anna Neistat, director of Human Rights Watch in Moscow, there is no evidence of any links between human rights organisations and terrorists. That may be true, but that doesn't stop NGOs being guilty of moral terrorism in Sultigov's eyes. These NGOs have the cheek to support Chechens struggling for freedom against the might of the Russian army. Then these NGOs have the nerve to publicise the struggle of these Chechen terrorists with woolly liberal political ideas such as freedom. So yes, the NGOs are guilty of terrorising the morals of poor Russians with images of massacred Chechens. According to Schnews, those silly liberal NGOs should try and emulate the upstanding Kremlin, who aren't petty moral terrorists, but successful state terrorists. They don't just terrorise people's morals, they massacre entire villages. The Kremlin claims that the war in Chechnya is coming to an end, but crime and violence still plague the Republic, and Chechens say that Russian forces commit murder, rape and other abuses. Those fluffy human rights groups continue to speak out for Chechens, but since Putin repackaged the conflict as part of the global war on terror, the West has stopped listening.
The Czech government has included Indie Media in a list of extremist organisations reviewed in a report covering last year's events, 2002, specifically in relation to the NATO summit protests in Prague, November 2002. In the report, they accuse IMC Prague of aiming to control and coordinate the development of protest events. This is the latest in a long line of attacks on indie media from Stanislav Gross, Minister of the Interior and the Czech state. 3 years ago, after the anti-IMF World Bank protests in Prague, Stanislav Gross, who was in charge of the policing then, reported that a foreign country had been working to destabilise the Czech state and to attack the reputation of the police. Indie Media was later named. Then during the NATO summit in November 2002, as mentioned in the government report, the handful of Indie Media volunteers in Prague were subject to a high level of surveillance and intimidation, were followed and spied upon by undercover police and security agents from different countries, through the streets, into bars, and while eating in restaurants. A major Czech daily newspaper then alleged that extremists were in Prague posing as independent journalists, but that instead of writing articles, they were plotting to orchestrate a riot. The small group of Indie Media volunteers kept their nerve, however, and continued to update the website. The smear stories and intimidation stopped when the protests turned out to be peaceful, as asserted all along by Eastern European anarchist blocs who organised them.
And some kind of good news. Mention the word school dinners and many of us start reaching for the sick bag or think of chips with everything. But one woman who works at St. Peter's Primary School in Nottingham has changed all that. Jeanette Ory started providing school meals on site using as many organic and locally produced ingredients as possible. Excuse me. And although ingredient costs have doubled, the cost of a dinner has stayed the same, thanks to cutting out contract suppliers and bureaucracy. Soaring demand for school meals at St. Peter's has also helped. 80% of the kids eat there now, compared to a national average of 45%. Dinner time has also taken on an educational role. Kids designing menus and learning about and the amount of pollution caused by food travelling thousands of miles. Parents can now eat at the school any day, and on Wednesdays, senior citizens are served by some of the older children who then sit and eat with them.
Last week, the Evening Standard finally confessed to faking parts of a front-page photograph of Liberation of Baghdad. In a small statement, they said, "A number of readers have expressed concern that our front-page picture on the 9th of April, showing Iraqis celebrating the liberation of Baghdad, had been enhanced to depict a larger crowd than actually existed. As it was taken from TV footage, some extra people were added to the image in order to fill the space left by the removal of logos from the picture." This is the same excuse published on Indie Media back in April after Indie Media volunteers phoned the Evening Standard's picture desk asking for an explanation of why the same people appeared several times in the same crowd. Despite the plausible explanation, many observers still question the professionalism of a newspaper that so readily doctors photographs and assumes the publishing of the picture was a breach of the PCC's code of practice.
A request made by the owners of nuclear power plant Hinkley Point B to have their business rates deferred last year has been declared provisionally unlawful by the European Commission. Hinkley B joined other British energy nuclear power stations in requesting a deferral on payments of business rates between November and March, making a net saving of over £4 million. But this was an unlawful, according to the European Commission document sent to the UK government last week. The extra benefits above the controversial £650 million government loan to BE, while it's courted bankruptcy, contravened competition laws. At the time, campaigners praised West Somerset District Council for refusing the rates deferral, but other councils near BE nuclear power stations gave in. A Green Party city councillor in Lancaster blew the whistle on the secret discussions and now faces disciplinary action by the council. Jim Duffy, spokesman for the campaign group Stop Hinkley, said, "Renewable energy operators were put at a disadvantage by this favouritism, requested furtively by the nuclear industry, while council taxpayers paid the bill. Luckily, West Somerset didn't succumb to Hinkley B's illegal proposition." The Commission also announced a full inquiry into the British Energy Rescue deal.
On Sunday, July the 20th, in City Hall, Cardiff, a life-size statue commemorating the original women's march to the then nuclear base at Greenham Common, together with a plaque, were unveiled by Jill Evans, MEP and original Greenham woman. The statue of a mother holding a baby was draped in delicate mauve muslin with suffragette coloured ribbons, purple, green and white, on their wrists. There were wild flowers around her feet. On the plaque was a poem in Welsh and English. The statue of the mother and baby tells the story of Greenham. She will keep alive the memory of this Women's Action for Peace, which started from Cardiff in 1981 and went around the world.
Indie Media Cinema presents Necropolis Now, about urban redevelopment and gentrification, Thursday the 31st of July at the Other Cinema at 11 Rupert Street, London W1. The entrance fee is £5 waged, £4 unwaged, and the evening kicks off at 9:30. So get down to the Indie Media Cinema screening at the Other Cinema, which is tomorrow. The event's tomorrow, so enjoy. And now we're going to a track. It's called Yola Tengo, and it's Nuclear War, and it's on the War Not Peace CD, and I think it's a pretty amazing track.
Okay, here we go. We have a story now of the reconstruction, or should we say deconstruction, of Iraq by Rihanna Masri and edited by R. Sean here in the studio. This report has come in to us concerning the spoils of war contracts advanced to the US preferred corporate companies from electronicirac.net. Halliburton privatizing Iraq's oil resources. Halliburton was awarded by the Pentagon a secret no-bid contract worth as much as $7 billion, months before the U.S. military dropped bombs and missiles on Iraq. The War Department was secretly working with Vice President Dick Cheney's old company Halliburton on a deal that would give the world's second-largest oil services company total control over Iraq's oil fields. The company has been given control of the Iraqi oil operations, including oil distribution.
and corporate warrior number two, Bechtel, privatising Iraq's water. Bechtel received a no-bid contract from US Agency for International Development, USAID, on the 17th of April 2003. The contract provides for emergency repair or rehabilitation of power generation facilities, electrical grids, municipal water systems, sewage systems, airport facilities, the dredging, repair and upgrading of the Umm Qasr seaport, before the seaport was even occupied by the US military, and reconstruction of hospitals, schools, ministry buildings, irrigation structures and transportation links. Its declared goal is to repair or rehabilitate up to 100 hospitals, 6,000 schools out of approximately 25,000, up to 6 airports and 1 southern seaport. The contract is for $34.6 million initially, up to $680 million over 18 months, and could eventually be worth up to $100 billion, thus making it potentially the largest Iraq reconstruction contract. In California, Bechtel installed one of their nuclear power plant reactors backwards. Not a good record there, then. In Bolivia, Bechtel was part of a consortium which took control of the water supply and increased prices by an average of 35%. Many in the city of Cochabamba could not afford to pay, and street protests led to several deaths. Bechtel is not a company that has a sound social or environmental track record, said Juliette Beck of Public Citizen. It should not be involved in the humanitarian reconstruction of Iraq. Bechtel and privatization go hand in hand, she continued. Their record depicts that trend. They privatise the service, they raise the price, and only those who can afford it get it, says Antonio Yuhas of the International Forum on Globalisation in San Francisco. If one were to define a core democratic decision a people could make, the treatment of things like water and power and media would be it, said Benjamin Barber, author of newly released book Fears, Empire, War, Terrorism and Democracy. It's a pretty basic part of government.
The Research Triangle Institute, RTI, of North Carolina was awarded a contract by USAID on April 11, 2003. The contract is for $7.9 million initially and up to $167.9 million over 12 months. RTI's contract provides for the strengthening of management skills and capacity of local administrations and civic institutions to improve delivery of essential municipal services such as water, health, public sanitation and economic governance. Includes training programs in communications, conflict resolution, leadership skills and political analysis. No uproar on this contract, though RTI had given no money to the Republican partners. No RTI board members are tied to the Pentagon. Cheney is not on the RTI payroll. Seems rather innocent, right? Not at all. RTI's president and CEO, Victoria Franceschiffi Haynes, openly sees RTI as a vehicle for advancing corporate interests. Under her leadership, RTI has aggressively pursued relationships with pharmaceutical, healthcare and biotechnology industries, in addition to many more benign government and non-profit contracts. Let's look again at the RTI contract. One of the major overarching issues is RTI's work in building allegedly strong indigenous democratic governments. Is this merely PR to smooth relations between the Iraqi people and the occupying power? Each step of RTI's project identifying indigenous leaders, training administrators and political analysts, opens a door for smuggling in pro-US propaganda and generally making Iraq's political climate more hospitable to US interests.
The second related issue is whether in the process of designing and implementing programs to enhance or improve basic human services, RTI will advance the interests of the people or the interests of the business elite, foreign and domestic. RTI will likely push heavily for corporate control as opposed to public control of municipal services, just as they did in Eastern Europe. In South Africa, this privatisation agenda has been a total disaster. For example, a huge French multinational took over the water services during the late 1990s and quickly hiked up rates and turned off water supplies to entire poor townships, sparking riots and strikes. A recent report by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists claims those efforts to privatise water systems in South Africa led to a cholera outbreak as people unable to pay higher rates started drinking from polluted streams, ponds and lakes. The outbreak killed nearly 300 people. If RTI pushes for the same thing in Iraq, and there is no reason to believe that RTI will act differently, then RTI will be ensuring US control over Iraqi society long after the armies are gone. It is neoliberal occupation, but still occupation. Already, RTI is identifying public waterworks specialists to provide short-term and long-term technical assistance in Iraqi water supply and distribution systems to provide Iraqi counterparts with the knowledge, skills and abilities to repair and sustain Iraqi water systems. The context for all this is the history of USAID, which contracted RTI. As an arm of the government, it largely engages in development projects that are in line with US political and military interests. It has also long been criticised for having overly close ties to corporate America, and its projects end up as tools to help businesses penetrate new markets. RTI also received a subcontract from USAID via Creative Associates International in Washington, D.C., for education system reform. This contract ignited much controversy when it was revealed that there were plans to rewrite Iraqi school textbooks, i.e. making them more pro-US. Reports conflict as to whether that aspect of the contract has now been cut or de-emphasised. How RTI's activities play out on the ground should be closely monitored, and we need to not only focus on Bechtel and Halliburton, but other large contracts, but vigilantly monitor RTI as well.
Other culprits to monitor are DynCorp Aerospace Operations, which are UK, a subsidiary of Computer Science Corporations, CSC, awarded by the US State Department Bureaus of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, a $22 million contract that could grow to $500 million to re-establish police, justice and prison functions in post-conflict Iraq. As noted by The Observer, by hiring military contractors such as DynCorp, the US government has found an effective way to conduct foreign policy by proxy and in secret. These proxies cannot be monitored, are effectively immune from all criminal sanctions, and are dangerously hard to control since they answer to corporate bosses, not military officials. In Bosnia, DynCorp personnel were involved in sex slave trading of young girls as well as a number of other fraudulent acts. In Ecuador, farmers filed a class action lawsuit and charged that DynCorp recklessly sprayed their homes and farms, causing illnesses and deaths and destroying crops.
And the next track we've got is to be released shortly, is one of its on a single that is going to hopefully raise funds for Simon Chapman, who has been accused of rioting in Thessaloniki last month. Well, falsely accused, we think. And the track is by The Stabilizers, and it's called Shit List.
Now you're in the just miss opportunity knocks. You ride off your feet, blistered and bleeding, and dead in the street. Well, it's just a phase.
Listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Your radical radio.
Hello, right, we're coming back. We've got more news from Iraq because we just think the stories are very important to see what is happening in Iraq since the war has supposedly finished.
Over 50 US soldiers have died since George W. Bush declared major military operations over on May the 1st. The war is not over. Phase 1 was the 1991 Gulf War. Phase 2 was the 12 and a half years of sanctions. Phase 3 was the 2003 bombing and invasion of Iraq. Phase 4, this current war, is the occupation of Iraq and the corporate invasion. This is no liberation. It is a process of selective exclusion of the elements of Iraqi political and economic life that do not further Western corporate or the allies' interests in the region. Any genuinely representative Iraqi group is excluded from power. The talk is of reconstruction. The reality is the country is up for sale to the highest US bidder. Bremer has said Iraq is open for business. A major goal of the country's reconstruction, he says, would be to shift Iraq away from state-dominated economies. These plans fit well with Bush's US Middle East Free Trade Area proposal, which calls for a market open for Israeli and US hegemony, thus demanding not only military occupation of Palestinian and Syrian lands and the Khibar farms of Lebanon, but also economic occupation of the region.
On the ground, the occupation forces are quickly working towards selling the Iraqi governmental services to private companies. Bremer revealed the contracts are pending to sell everything from oilfield technology to transportation services and telecommunications, even Iraqi ministries. The sell-off of Iraqi companies and ministries is to take place soon. Tim Carney, US-appointed ruler of the Iraqi Ministry of Industry and Minerals, said that dozens of Iraqi state-owned companies would be earmarked for privatizations within a year. Previously, the US occupying force said it would wait until an elected Iraqi government had been appointed before it would start privatization. The Industry and Minerals Ministry controls 48 state-owned enterprises employing approximately 96,000 people in eight sectors, including food, textiles, engineering and chemicals. Glass and ceramics firms are to be privatized within a year. Iraqi textile companies viewed by the US as money-losing firms will be dissolved, meaning workers will lose their jobs. Numerous other Iraqi firms would be sold to foreign companies.
Iraqi economic laws and tax rates will be charged to create a better environment for US companies, and as the power in charge of imports to and investments in Iraq, the US has proposed a temporary holiday on customs and duties on imported goods. UN Resolution 1472, March 28, 2003, transfers legal control over Iraq's oil industry from the United Nations and Iraq to the United States and its allies. Iraq's agricultural industry will be run primarily by Dan Amstrutz, the former senior executive of the Cargill Corporation, the biggest grain exporter in the world, and president of the North American Grain Export Association, Bush Jr., has stated that he wants U.S. farmers to feed the world. Putting Dan Amstrutz in charge of agricultural reconstruction in Iraq is like putting Saddam Hussein in the chair of a human rights commissioner, said Oxfam. the British aid agency in June. This guy is uniquely well placed to advance the commercial interests of American grain companies and bust open the Iraqi market, but singularly ill-equipped to lead a reconstruction effort in a developing country. The former director of Voice of America, Robert Riley, has been entrusted by the occupiers to overhaul Iraq's radios, newspapers and television and manage Iraq's media in order to sell US policies in Iraq. This pro-war conservative ideologue believes that delivering the news is not enough. We also have the duty to reveal the character of the American people in such a way that the underlying principles of American life are revealed.
Newspapers that publish wild stories, material deemed provocative or capable of inciting ethnic violence or violence against the occupying forces, will be threatened or shut down. All Iraqi media must now be registered. Licenses will be revoked and equipment confiscated from media sources that break the rules. Individual offenders may be detained, arrested, prosecuted, and if convicted, sentenced by relevant authorities to up to 1 year in prison and a $1,000 fine. Not long ago, a rebellious writer could easily be accused of being an agent for the US or Israel. Now they put plastic bags on our heads and throw us to the ground and accuse us of being agents of Saddam Hussein, said one editor. In other words, if you're not with America, you're with Saddam. In this phase three of the war against Iraq, more than 240,000 cluster bombs were dropped on Iraq. In addition, one third of the bombs dropped on Iraq were old-style dumb weapons, despite suggestions from the Pentagon that 90% of munitions used would be precision-guided. If we regard the killing of almost 3,000 people on September the 11th to be a massacre, then we need to admit that there were massacres in Iraq. Almost 7,000 Iraqi civilians, possibly 10,000, were killed in the bombing war on Iraq, according to www.iraqbodycount.net. At least another 8,000 were injured in Baghdad alone. May the 18th, 2003, Los Angeles Times. These figures do not include the thousands of Iraqi soldiers who died fighting to defend their country from invading forces. Meanwhile, limited access to clean water heralds widespread epidemics. The casualties of the peace might well exceed those casualties of the war.
बदनाम करने के लिए आपने उन पे इल्जाम लगाया कि उन्होंने जबरदस्ती आपकी
ऐसा धंधा आपके खानदान की लड़कियां करती होंगी, मैं नहीं करती.
यू ब्लडी
खबरदार, जो एक भी लफ्ज गलत बोला तो आपको शर्म नहीं आती अपनी बेटी जैसी लड़की से ऐसी बात कहते हुए?
fundamental rape tactic of war. And some good news. At 11 a.m. on Tuesday, 29th of July, the Manchester Museum returned four skulls of Australian Aborigines, which were collected 100 years ago back into the safekeeping of representatives of Aboriginal communities to which they properly belong. A delegation of Aboriginal elders took possession of the remains of their ancestors and accompanied them back to Australia, following an agreement between the Foundation for Aboriginal and Islander Research Action and the University of Manchester for their repatriation. The ancestors will be returned to their traditional homelands in the state of Victoria and to a sacred keeping place in the Australian Capital Territory. Bob Weatherall from the Foundation for Aboriginal and Islander Research says, "This will end the practice of scientific investigations and maintaining Aboriginal ancestors in cardboard boxes, plastic bags and vaults in museums." Mr. Weatherall welcomed the decision taken by the University of Manchester, which, along with the Royal College of Surgeons and the Horniman Museum in London, demonstrates an enlightened attitude to the rights of Indigenous peoples. Tristram Besterman, director of the Manchester Museum, said, "The return of the remains of the ancestors of living Indigenous Australians is an act that recognises our common humanity. These remains were removed during the colonial era at a time of great inequality of power. Their removal more than a century ago was carried out without the permission of the Aboriginal nations and have been held in the Manchester Museum ever since in violation of the laws and beliefs of Indigenous Australian people. The Manchester Museum cannot atone for the wrongs of our forebearers at a time when different values prevailed. Nonetheless, by returning these remains now, we hope to contribute to ending the sense of outrage and dispossession felt by Australian Aborigines today, and trust that we can begin to build a more rewarding relationship based on mutual understanding and respect between our peoples for the future. The torment is ended. We now put an end to the torment. We are taking them home to our traditional lands," said Major Sumner, a traditional custodian from the
Ngarrindjeri Nation
in South Australia. At the handover ceremony in Manchester, Mr. Sumner welcomed the four directions according to the traditions of his people. For information, check out the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders Commission at www.atsic.gov.au.
Right, now we have a story from Afghanistan, another country that has been subjected to American rebuilding. In Afghanistan, human rights are again under threat, this time not because of the evil Taliban, but due to US and friends. A Human Rights Watch report states, "Human Rights Watch goes so far as to state the adoption of a new constitution is imperiled and the national election scheduled for mid-2004 could be derailed." By what? By violence, political intimidation, attacks on women and girls, all of which discourages political participation and endangers gains made on women's rights over the last year. In short, a brutal peace following a brutal war have not created the kind of environment in which human rights and essential liberties are likely to flourish. Brad Adams of Human Rights Watch says human rights abuses in Afghanistan are being committed by gunmen and warlords who were propelled into power by the United States and its coalition partners after the Taliban fell in 2001. These men and others have essentially hijacked the country outside of Kabul. With less than a year to go before national elections, Afghanistan's human rights situation appears to be worsening.
In the report, Killing You is a Very Easy Thing for Us, that's available at www.hrw.org, you can read about the behaviour of the army and police troops in Afghanistan. Incidents documented include kidnapping Afghans and holding them for ransom in unofficial prisons, breaking into households and robbing families, raping women, girls and boys, and extorting shopkeepers and bus, truck and taxi drivers. And I think we've got a bit of an outro to play, so go and have a look at that report on the Human Rights Watch website.
And we've got to play out, we've got two reports which came from radio.indymedia.org about three nuns who sabotaged a Minuteman atomic silo, and a Danish woman who sabotaged, I think, a tornado in Scotland, but it's all on the audio reports. So we'll see you next week.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Wednesday, 104.4 Resonance FM.
212. This is Michael Franti here from Spearhead, and you're listening to Indie Media's London Radio, connecting London with the rest of the planet. Stand firm, stay human, hold the vibes, and give the corporation some complications.
Sisters Carol Gilbert, 55, Jackie Hudson, 68, and Ardith Platty, 66, gave their elocutions outside the Denver Federal Courthouse on the morning of their sentencing, Friday, July 25th, as they refused to give any further statements within a court's walls that would not hear their legal defense arguments. Charged with federal crimes of obstruction of national defense, destruction of government property, and sabotage, these three Dominican nuns committed a nonviolent symbolic act to disarm a Minuteman III nuclear missile in Weld County, Colorado. They claim their trial was turned from a case regarding legalities to one of politics by the courts and against their best efforts to stick to the law. Frida Beringer of the War Resisters League introduces the nuns, beginning with Sister Gilbert, followed by Sister Hudson, and then Sister Platty.
Ardith and Carol and Jackie wear black and will stand silent today as a way of carrying into that court the voices of women throughout the world and their anguish over war and preparations for war. They carry women's pleas from around the world, pleas and courageous acts for peace, justice, and conversion. They have chosen to make their final statements before all of you and not to Judge Blackburn and the court that has protected war crimes.
For the past 10 months, we have tried to cooperate with these courts. We have been asking since day one, what are the charges? What is Title 18, U.S. Code Section 2155, if not sabotage? We are not saboteurs. Today, we ask no more questions. We know something is very wrong with a system that can incarcerate us for years in prison for inspecting, exposing, and symbolically disarming America's weapons of mass destruction. We know we should be acquitted for upholding the United States Constitution.
Well, today is the day. It holds many unknowns as regards the judgments, decisions of Judge Blackburn, and yet it holds many knowns. The continued presence of nuclear weapons. The latest figure of U.S. ownership is 10,455 weapons in the U.S. arsenal. Another known, a president in office who has stated publicly that he would use these weapons. A national budget that would allow these weapons of mass extermination to be multiplied and present ones upgraded.
In the sacred moments of the years of imprisonment, I will remain with you in prayer and walk together with you for the good of all humanity and all of creation. My love and my gratitude to you always. Thank you.
Could you tell me your name and why you came down here?
My name
this morning?
My name is Pat Gasnick, and I'm from Arvada. We're from a group called the Arvada Peace and Justice Commission, which just began in January. The reason I'm here is I have 9 children, a lot of grandchildren, 17 grandchildren. I'm concerned about their future and our government's policies toward making war easily and just even the rhetoric of war. And I'm here to support these nuns whom I consider have really stood against the grain, stood against our culture, stood against the government, and really in a peaceful way, I feel, nonviolent way. And I think that's where we need to go. We need to do more negotiation, more nonviolent actions. And we're in solidarity with them and just delighted to be here to support them in some any way we can.
Thank you very much.
They gave a message that should be heard all over the country, all over the world. I've been involved in the peace movement for many decades, and I'm convinced that war is evil and is a crime against humanity. And anyone who fosters war should be tried as a war criminal. I'm Joe Stern. I live in Fort Collins.
May God's peace abide in you. May God's presence illuminate your heart now and forever.
That's our blessing for you to keep the movement going.
You're listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Your radical radio.
What is the name of the campaign? What is it about?
The campaign is called Free Ulla Campaign. It's as simple as that. And basically, Ulla Roder, she's a Danish peace protester. She destroyed a tornado jet on the 11th of March. And she is currently on remand in Cornton Vale Prison in Stirling. Trial begins on the 30th of June. So this campaign has been started really to highlight that Ulla is in prison so that people don't forget about her and to bring to public attention what she's done and why she did it.
So what has she done and why has she done it?
She actually reached a tornado jet without being seen, and she took her hammer to it and smashed it up. She smashed the nose, inside the cockpit, the fuselage, all around the aeroplane. She smashed the whole thing. Then she sat down quietly and waited to be arrested, which is what child pleasures type actions. People are open and accountable for what they've done. Going to be facing a serious charge probably of at least £1 million, I think.
So that had to do with the anti-war activities?
Yeah, Ulla wanted to protest against the war in Iraq because those tornado jets were going directly to Iraq. So she felt that by doing that, she at least was stopping some innocent Iraqi civilians from being killed.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the philosophy of Trident Ploughshares?
Trident Ploughshares, it was started in 1998, focused on the Trident nuclear submarines at Faslane. And the idea was that people would get together in small groups and do major disarmament actions against the submarines and be open and accountable and take responsibility for their actions. And there have been a few successful actions against Trident. You probably know about them. Spray painting the submarine, getting inside a submarine. Yeah, there was an action at Shannon Airport. Again, Ploughshares action it was. And one of them is from Faslane Peace Camp. Her name's Karen Fallon. They're actually on bail at the moment, but Karen's not allowed to leave Ireland. And their trial starts later this month as well. They did a lot of damage to an aircraft there and the runway at Shannon Airport because that's where the planes are refueling on their way to Iraq. And the Irish government are supposed to be neutral. They're not supposed to, you know, get involved in those things. So,
yeah, are you in contact with Ulla? How is she feeling at the moment?
I haven't seen her recently, but I know that she's got lots of people writing to her and visiting, and I think, you know, that keeps her strength up. But as you can imagine, it must be difficult to be in there for so many months on her own. But I know Ulla's a strong person. She's been through prison before. She'll cope.
What is the aim of the support campaign?
Give Ulla as much support as possible, and they've come up with a really good idea of the postcard with a heart on it, and it says,